Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. This show will focus on the hidden elements that have influenced Wabanaki history, from the invasion of our shores in the 18th century to land claims and beyond. In the previous show, we interviewed David DeJong on his book, Nazi Billionaires. I want to follow up on that interview and, drill down on a couple of issues that I thought sort of went with that interview, and that I think is important even today in current Wabanaki issues. So our guest today, our professor is Harold Prins, a Dutch citizen of the Netherlands, distinguished professor of anthropology and emeritus at the University of Kansas. Professor Darren Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation and professor of anthropology and chair of Native American studies at the University of Maine. Welcome, Harold and Darren. We've all had time to review that interview with David DeJong. There are a number of things that sort of drew my attention, but let's talk about your thoughts. And I'm going to start with Harold. What did you think about that interview, Harold?
Thank you for inviting me, Donna. And again, Darren, wonderful to see you again on the radio show where we discuss the complex issues of sovereignty, but also how the issue of sovereignty, land claims, and therefore land loss is connected to capital that was brought to Wabanaki country by investors who tried to make profits of the lands that were ancestral and are ancestral to the Wabanaki nations. And the interview with David Jong, a fellow Dutchman who interviewed from Tel Aviv, right there where currently is a major battle raging about who owns the land, who has the rights to the land. And so in many ways, what is going on in not just the Middle East with respect to the Palestinians and the Jewish settlers, in particular in the West Bank, and in the Gaza area, but also in many other parts of the world, whether we talk about New Zealand with the Maori or Brazil with the Portuguese and so forth and so on. We see everywhere across the world, we see indigenous peoples facing settlers who are aiming at dispossession. And these settlers very often don't come without anything in terms of either weapons or capital. So behind the settlers, and also here in Maine, were speculators, land speculators, who needed human labor, social labor, as it's called sometimes. They needed labor in order to make that land productive in a way that fitted the capitalist economy more effectively, and in particular for the people who are looking out for profits. And so the linkage between what David was talking about, not about the Middle East, he did not want to get into it, which I understand, but his book was about the Nazi billionaires and how there was a complicity between the wealthy industrial capitalists like Alfred Krupp, K-R-U-P-F, in case anyone wants to look it up, is Alfred, A-L-F-R-E-D, K-R-U-P-F, but many others, including the founding owners of the Volkswagen factories, Siemens, many of the big German industrial businesses originally built on steel and iron, they threw their hat in the ring with the National Socialists in the 1930s. And what has happened, and it was the point of David de Jong's book, a very successful book, was that he showed that the rise of Nazi power and the war machine could not have happened without the active support of these industrialists and their capital. And then after the war, when a number of the major political and military leaders on the German Nazi state were incarcerated and many of whom were hanged in case they hadn't already committed suicide, that these industrialists who also were condemned for war crimes because of the use of slave labor in their major factories, that they were also incarcerated and condemned for many years of prison time, minimally. But then, in a rather surprising way, were let out of prison. And their prison situation wasn't that bad, as many other prisoners were. And then very soon rose back to prominence in Germany. And so there's been this interesting case that on the one hand, the German state has continued to have an exceptional position toward the state of Israel as an atonement for their sins, if you will. But at the same time, the complicity of the big capitalist millionaires has kind of been forgotten and papered over. And indeed, Alfred Krupp, who I just mentioned before, less than, I think, 6 years after he was left out of jail with American help, was featured the cover of Time magazine as Man of the Year. So the linkage between that and I think what Donna Loring, as our host, would like to see us explore was to what extent there are certain parallels. The differences are obvious. The question is, what are the similarities between that collective amnesia, forgetfulness, papering over, and to what extent that also has happened here with respect to not only the military dispossession of indigenous peoples by militias, for example, but also by who financed that and who ultimately benefited from it. And the names of James Bowdoin has come up several times, but he, of course, was not only the governor of Massachusetts, but was also the father of the man who founded Bowdoin College, which was officially incorporated in 1794. It didn't immediately get going until, I think, 1802 or so. But here we see that, for example, the land statement that people now at Bowdoin College like to read from, ditto, by the way, with Colby College. I was thinking about that neither place could have existed without the establishment of forts. In the case of Bowdoin, Fort George, founded, I think, in 1713 or maybe 1715, but very early on, that was to withhold the Wabanaki trying to fight off the invaders, and that made that land free for the establishment for Colby College, for example, and ditto with Fort Halifax at the confluence of the Sebasticook and the Kennebec River, was founded, I think, in 1754. But without that fort, those two forts, the genocide against the Kennebec Abenaki would not have happened. And of course, today, in August 2024, we will have the centennial, of course, of the massive attack on Norridgewock, Narrantswak, there, right at that same place. So the whole situation, in terms of what we would like, I would like to see people remember, is that all these hallowed places, Bowdoin College, Colby College, Bates College, they're all founded, of course, on territories that were vacated by ethnic cleansing as well as genocide.
That's a pretty good recap, Harold. Thanks for that. I mean, it's been like a couple of weeks, and it's always hard to remember what we last talked about, especially for the audience. And I will say that the last radio show we had is archived, so you know people should go check that out. So, Darren, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting listening to the show, and Harold, you know shared I think some commonality with your countrymen in some ways, but I think also, you know, quite a bit of differences. Your thoughts on how settler colonialism kind of functions with the kinds of capitalism that you all talked about. It was interesting that I think he talked about capitalism as amoral, so which is different than saying it's immoral, I think, in my opinion, and didn't necessarily. I mean, I think that's, you know, if you think about, you know, theorizing why the kinds of democracies that exist in, you know, lots of places around the world today, like how inequity, you know, is still so dramatic in those places where there are sort of a one person, one vote, you know, the thing that keeps the, you know, the the river crooked and the pieces of the haves having and the have-nots have not, you know, is capitalism. And I'm not, you know, being critical of capitalism doesn't mean I'm praising another system. I'm just really pointing out that settler nation states and settler colonialism has gone hand in hand with the frameworks of capitalism, the you know, accumulation of vast, you know, more than you need of land resources, right? All of those things, and then sort of filling in labor with either slave labor or exploited labor, be that with imported slavery or local indigenous people who don't control their own systems of freedom, and then now into this sort of sphere where we, you know, have the kinds of capitalism that hinder people's freedoms, right? Freedoms of expression, freedoms of choice. Capitalism is supposed to be about choice, but it's so inevitably propped up or unregulated by people that it's really a system that creates unjust outcomes all the time. And it's not been deemed to tie capitalism, which in sort of the liberal democracies of the US, you know, North America, Europe, you know, the kind of intelligentsia of the world, to really critique capitalism makes you a kind of political outsider. You know, you're seen as a kind of crazy whack. Although as people on the far right start to align themselves with tyranny, you know, with forms of illiberal, you know, kind of thought and you know, the book bannings, the kind of strong man, you know, tyrant for a day, whatever they're kind of saying, this creates such a big space for billionaire sort of shadow monies, you know, the ways in which that, you know, and I think last time you had mentioned when we were talking in the last week or two, the piece about billionaires funding the kind of press coverage of the campus protests against what's happening in Palestine, and that they're, you know, that this is kind of like an orchestrated move, that the poor students are unwittingly feeding a narrative that the billionaires wanted to help influence this election, right? That this is making it seem like this like nefarious far left takeover of cultural institutions, you know, ignoring the very long traditions of campus protests against wars and against killing that have gone back for, you know, decades and decades. That idea is also bleeding into other sort of press frameworks. I was just reading the new Atlantic has a piece by Ann Applebaum called "Democracy is Losing the Propaganda War." So the idea is simply that what happened in the late 1980s into early 90s, which saw the collapse of sort of Soviet communism in Eastern and Central Europe, and how that spread to other parts of the world, but was stamped out in China at the same time, the playbook that people are learning from is not that billionaires and media influences, what they're learning from that situation is not how did we get to the, you know, more open societies and more democratic institutions in those, you know, Eastern and Central European countries. But in fact, the lessons that they're gleaning and reincorporating are, what did China do to make it so it didn't happen there, right? So it's kind of like this billionaire media kind of conglomerate space. You know, we have billionaires, you know, owning the Washington Post, what is formerly Twitter, owning, you know, a lot of the media. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. I'm just saying that, you know, the frameworks of what is happening in coverage and the politics of our coverage and the coverage of our politics is very familiar It's familiar even in the settler frameworks where dehumanizing and scapegoating are such critical pieces of the settler frameworks, right? To make people seem barbarous or violent or not worthy of di basic dignity because of associations with people who are fighting a against your friends. You know, these are the things that worry me, significantly in terms of just painting groups of people, and I'm thinking Palestinians, I mean, in some situations too, Israelis too, being painted in this way. The dehumanization, especially because there's so much more money and framework of and access to resources on certain sides of these issues, as there always have been, right? So the proprietors that gave the that created the Kennebec River settlements for people coming from southern New England, these were the billionaires of the day. They needed to dehumanize indigenous people in the 1750s. You know, having a scalp proclamation was built upon dehumanizing people. The fact that you could just kill people because of who their identity is, take their scalps, get money for that. Like, all of that is built upon a radical form of dehumanization and guilt by association that was like, they use spats on the frontier in colonial era media, right? So that so-and-so settler was killed by an Indian, over here in Falmouth in 1747 or whatever. What, all these Harold and Donna, like they used that moment of a dispute to then basically wage a war that was built upon dehumanizing. And that was put forward by those with great resources and influence, again, the billionaires of the day, who had at the end point a vision of destroying everything that we as Indigenous people had before they came, and that they would build upon that after our destruction. So I think the dehumanization, its connections to the kind of capitalist sort of desires, which I would call immoral, the immoral sort of frameworks of capitalism. We see this happening in all sorts of familiar ways now. Sometimes it has people who have been formerly victims of this morass now being perpetrators, or at least participating in its system. And it's a very worrisome space for us to address anything in terms of fighting for justice, trying to draw out the similarities between how we as Indigenous people get dehumanized and how our basic rights and our sovereignty are kept from us through a series of lies and misrepresentations of us. So it's ongoing.
Yeah, I do. I want to point out that the article that you referred to was by the billionaires that were repressing student protest. That was out of the Washington Post article. It was dated 5/16/24.
That's right. Sorry. Yeah.
That point. But yeah, I mean, you see that the influence of billionaires right from the very beginning, from the invasion of the Europeans in the 1400s, 1500s, right up until now. And the dehumanization and the land thefts, and it's all sort of like it never changes. I mean, it's like the same thread, the same, what do we call it, method of operation throughout. Harold?
Yeah, so two things apropos to what Darren was earlier saying. He talked about the have-nots and the haves. There's, of course, a third category that we often forget, and it's relevant. That's the have-lots. So you have not just the haves and the have-nots, you also have the have-lots, and the billionaires are the have-lots. And that means that the power, that's the term here that comes to mind, then we talk about power, and we talk about the powerful and the powerless. And so what we see is a contestation, a conflict, whereby the sources of power, in the case of indigenous peoples, are severely weakened by, as we all know, not only warfare, but also alien diseases, right? So you get a massive depopulation as a result of pandemics. The situation for the Wabanaki nations became very serious even just before the pilgrims arrived in 1620. There was a major pandemic that raged all the way from where is now roughly Schoodick Point all the way down to Cape Cod area. And the estimate is 75 to 95% of the population was wiped out by these diseases against which the indigenous peoples had no immunity. So the human resources, the human power was already severely curtailed right from the beginning, before the settlers even set foot on land, if you will. And that, of course, has weakened the capacity for indigenous peoples to fight back. So it was not only superiority of resources in terms of, let's say, guns, but also manpower, right, and dynamite and cannons. So I mentioned these fortresses, these forts all along the Kennebec, and later, of course, Fort Pownall at the mouth of the Penobscot River. There were also all choke points to make sure that people were being starved. So the access lines for food from the Penobscot Bay to Indian Island village, for example, and other villages upriver, the resources from the sea were suddenly compromised as a result of these choke points. And there was also the function of Fort George at where is now Brunswick, here on the Androscoggin. And it was that was also the function of Fort Richmond, where you lived, Donna. There was a choke point for the Kennebec. And later another choke point was Fort Western, right opposite the state capital. And then, of course, you had Fort Halifax, which I mentioned before, was another choke point that both cut off the upper Kennebec, but also the passageway along the Sebastopol River to the Kanduskeg into the Penobscot. So these are all strategically located strongholds to stifle any opposition from the indigenous peoples who are trying to fight back over the course of six Anglo-Wabanaki wars. And then when they threw in their lot with the American revolutionaries in 1775, when Chief Joseph Orono came to Watertown to pledge the support on the side of the colonists against British colonial oppression, he had hoped, and he was naive perhaps, but he had hoped that the colonists would recognize a common struggle of oppressed people. In the case of the colonists, on the one hand, and their taxation issue, and in the case of the Wabanaki, in terms of their land issue and the encroachments. So just to sum up, it's not just capitalism, but that itself is a manifestation of power. And when we talk about dispossession of indigenous peoples, we all know that the People's Republic of China, right, has been and continues to do a massive brutality, genocidal attack against the peoples of Tibet, but also against the Uyghur, right? The Uyghur, the Turkic-speaking people of Western China. And we hardly hear anything about it because talking about media control, this is not an issue of capitalists that have the media in possession, but in this case, it's the all-powerful communist regime in Beijing. And that was, of course, also the case under the Tsars in Siberia, where ruthless campaigns to exterminate indigenous peoples in Siberia happened all through the 18th and 19th centuries, and then, of course, continued during the communist regime under Stalin. So that is all the common denominator of the powerful enriching themselves at the expense of indigenous peoples who become dispossessed, and if they survive, pauperized.
Okay, so these people that are in a powerful position, what actually put them there in the first place? Was it land? Was it money? Did that put them in these positions?
There are multiple pathways to power. One of them is capital accumulation, which is a means which provide people a means of purchasing mercenaries, for example. So can hire a poor man from the mountains in Switzerland, for example, or the mountains of Scotland, who have no real opportunities for survival on the small farms that they have inherited. So they become the hirelings, the mercenaries for the powerful. And that is being financed by capitalists, who are then financing the monarchs and the dukes and whatever you may have. And that is then paid for. These capitalists are then paid for through the revenue, for example, from mines, whether it's copper mines or iron mines or whatever, which are then taken. So it's really a complicated picture of how these capitalists themselves function in their rise to power. And they fuel the power of these tyrants, kings, counts, dukes, popes even. So there's all an issue of dispossession that happens through that way. One is the other one is, of course, through military conquest. You've always seen the people who have a certain upper hand in terms of horse riding skills, for example, that you saw with the Mongoloid herds under Genghis Khan, right? They could overrun the farming communities and raid them and rob them and then impose tribute, force them basically to pay up, or they would be killed or hanged or maimed or raped or all of the above. So the techniques, in other words, for accumulating power, whether that happens through capital itself or through human resources in terms of terrorizing populations and then forcing them to pay tribute, or to terrorize people in the form of capturing them and making them work as slaves. In other words, the pathways to power are multiple.
Darren?
Yeah, I think, I think it's like, you see breaks in this in the frontier, like quote unquote frontier in Maine. And you see this interesting set of rebellions against the proprietors in and along the coast of Maine, and they do some interesting things, like call themselves the White Indians of Maine, right, where they're trying to claim later deeds. They don't want to try to settle old deeds with these rich proprietors far away in Boston. You know, I think this sort of this idea of like creating a native class of, or a not native isn't probably the right thing, a more local class of billionaire, or a local class of landholder who is holding, you know, an inordinate amount of lands over others, but I mean against others as well, right? So you have it's interesting because you see that on the far right here in the US and across Europe, like, you know, the idea that the tyrant or the strongman will be your savior against this sort of class of bureaucrat or someone taking your freedom who's functioning as a something against your freedom. And so we see that playing out in Maine at different times as well, like where the kind of almost, you know, bloodless wars against proprietors who hold deeds very far away, people seizing working waterfronts from them in the 19th century. All of those things are really interesting breakages. And you could say that, you know, we have all these sort of ironies and twists today in our politics as well. People who are feeling left out by the little guy, or who self-style themselves the little guy and feel forgotten, siding with the people who are who have the most tyrannical kind of sort of implications with in collusion with billionaires to try to offer them this sort of fix on systems that are not speaking to them. I mean, it's a classic. This thing does. That does remind me of Germany. You guys talked a lot about, you know, the aftermath of World War I in Germany, you know, this sense that the economy wasn't great, the working class were suffering. They became more likely to believe, you know, blaming others for their problems, right? Because of those things. And that, again, that creates and supports the system of dehumanization and fear, which allow for tyranny and anti-democratic impulses to take hold. I think as a sort of foundation of settler colonialism and the settler nation states that within which we as Indigenous people reside, you know, that's the same kind of flimsy space that we seem to be occupying always, right? Like we're just, you know, part of, you know, Donna, you've reflected so well about this in many ways and many times that, you know, one of the reasons why we are trying to seize the moment and negotiate things with our sovereignty often is because we feel like if we've amassed a certain number of friends and the politics seems possible, we know or we feel in our hearts or in our experience that the other shoe will drop, right? Like that has been our experience for these last, you know, hundreds of years, you know, that people, the institutions that are more friendly to us today, like the state legislature, yesterday was engaging, as we've read the testimonials, right, from not too long ago, engaging in blatant dehumanization, fraudulent, underground, you know, workings to take more from us who have so little, you know. So I think we're kind of stuck in always trying to respond to this legacy of being an other that will be blamed for a problem. And so I'm just returning to that because I think, you know, I'm involved in the land return movements. We're involved in other also fundraising for other things. You know, there's a really strong part of me in the back of my mind that this will upset enough people or be seen as a big enough threat that, you know, much like with the Settlement Act or us having gaming or whatever, they're going to trot out the like terrible racist underpinnings of how we are, who we are as Indigenous people. And I think that's that's the fundamental piece of it, which is just part of the reality of what I think you were trying to get the guests last time to talk about, Donna, was seeing those parallels of like how dehumanization, institutions that support large amounts of capitalism, all of that sort of play out.
Yeah, I wanted to get a clearer picture of what's happening, what happened to us in the past, and what's happening now to us. I think that understanding, you know, if we take a piece of history, like, you know, Germany in the 30s and then after the war, I think that sort of makes clearer what we're dealing with, what the tribes here are dealing with. I'm not quite sure how to explain it, but my thought was that if we got a handle on what we're up against, we could create a knowledgeable or a strategic path forward, understanding that what we've done in the past is the clear definition of insanity, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over again. I want to try to avoid doing the same thing over and over again by education and understanding our history and the environment that we have to deal with. That's my thought. Harold?
As to the issue of basically what Darren was earlier referring to, although he didn't use the term, but it's the issue of false consciousness. And the idea of false consciousness is, of course, something that isn't happening by itself, that's engineered. And that false consciousness means that, for example, the working class is mystified deliberately by the media, for example, but also sometimes the educational institutions through what we sometimes refer to as the hegemony, whereby institutions of the state are being hijacked by very powerful interests, who then create an ideology, a worldview, in which people can situate themselves in comprehensible way, but it is not for their best interest, it's for the best interest for those who are manipulating history, for example, who are manipulating, fabricating the presence, and creating an illusion about future that's simply false. But meanwhile, you get the masses of the people beginning to march and hoisting the flags and do all kind of crazy stuff and end up in jail or bruised or dead or sued and they can't pay their bills. Well, the billionaires are literally in their villas on with their beautiful views on the mountains or on the sea and orchestrating the show. And the maddening thing is that has happened many times before. It happened under Mussolini with the rise of fascism. It happens currently in Argentina and many times before, where you get the so-called caudillos, the strongmen, who then make promises as if they are the messiah. And you get a strange conflation, very worrisome conflation of religion, ideology, and politics, and the idea of we were wronged and we're going to find the culprit. But almost always, the culprit is not the one that is really responsible. It's these ideologues who are very clever in the manipulation of the state. And the state can be manipulated by powerful people in China, for example, in the top of the Communist Party, or under Putin in Moscow with his oligarchs, or in Washington, D.C. with all these so-called think tanks. And the interesting thing about the word think tank, I've often thought about the strange word itself. Here are these tanks surrounding the White House and surrounding the Congress, the House and the Senate, and are perpetually feeding into the daily media. These think tanks are providing these so-called experts who are repeatedly coming and invited by CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and start saying, who pays for these people? Is it the networks that are paying for these people to do their daily propaganda when they're being asked for their opinion? Or who's there? What's the money machine that begins to explain to us as a public to how to understand what's really going on in Gaza, for example, or in Egypt, or in South America, or in the Amazon, or with climate warming? So you have to be very suspicious, I think, about many of these think tanks, because they are fueled, financially fueled, by very powerful interests. And it can be, for example, the big oil companies, it can be steel, it can be hedge funds, it can be all kinds of things. And what they are masters in is to obfuscate the sources. In other words, often they operate through foundations, and then you start saying who's behind that foundation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the complexity of modern society is enormous, and there are some people who actually understand how it works, and they understand the levers of power, and they have the means, the resources, to pull the levers of power. And meanwhile, people are glued to their so-called news, they're glued to the entertainment, they're glued to their professors sometimes, much less so than they used to be, I think, and are basically, when there are critical questions being asked at colleges and universities, those critical questions that you would have thought would be welcomed at educational institutions are now being silenced. And so the assault on the American educational institutions is very worrisome, in my view, and not only in this country, but also all over Western Europe, including my own country in the Netherlands, whereby critical discourse and critical thinking and raising questions that are uncomfortable should have a place at the educational institutions instead of being silenced, as we now see massively all across the United States in a, to my view, in a way that reminds me again what happened at the end of the Weimar Republic that Darren was earlier referring to, and what David de Jong had been described And that gave rise to a cleansing of the universities in Germany first, then Austria, and then the rest of Europe, of all the intelligentsia, many of whom were Jewish, but many were also socialists or communists or anybody else who had a perspective that was not welcome to the fascists. And fascism comes in many, many guises too.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always I just want to do the a couple of things, like, you know, this sort of Harold mentioned hegemony or not, and I think there's something about, you know, I think we're critical of media. I don't even know where people find out or get their media or understand their sort of the basics of the world that they move through. In the last, you know, I think I've lost a lot of Facebook friends, I think, in the last several years. I don't know. I'm not that political on Facebook, by the way. I mostly show pictures of dogs, as Donna, I think you realize that. But, you know, I think one thing that I am fascinated by is the idea that cheating. One thing that my non-native relations concerns them is things like the 4% cheat rate on things like welfare, right? So it's like poor people cheating a system, you know, and getting a couple thousand dollars here or there, versus what concerns me is, you know, billionaires cheating a system. Seems to be a more dramatic kind of thing. And I asked even my mother or someone I'm really, like, they keep bringing this up. I mean, I guess they're getting it, I don't know, I guess the Fox News, but I don't think my mom watches Fox News, but it's like, and they explained to me that, yeah, there probably are billionaires and they're probably stealing a lot more than, like, poor people, but I don't know any of them. I know these people who are cheating that system, and that's who I hate. You know, like that's like that sort of motivation to hate others that you can kind of almost know or already know. And that kind of system, how that plays into the capitalist sort of framework. You know, I think it's kind of like, you know, you talk to someone in Northern Penobscot County about tribal rights and everything, and be like, yeah, you guys have all those special benefits. You know, that's you have all these special, right? I'm like, wow, what are you talking about? You know, like, what are you saying? Like, there's so many people, like, in Maine that really think of us as having such special rights, you know. And I you ask them, where did you find this out? And they're like, I don't know, we just always known that you were so, you got so much more than we did, you know, that perpetuation of a lie. You know, I think, and I think of even the way that just that basic dehumanization kind of leads to what I would say, you know, perhaps, you know, part of the governor's position or the anti-sovereignty position, to me, distills into basically saying, we don't trust Indians. Like, we don't trust you with this sovereignty, that you will harm us in some way. You know, that's a presumption that we can't do it, or that we're not to be trusted in a lot of the debates against our sovereignty. But I think what, you know, what motivates that again is sort of billionaires, you know, people with money pulling strings, right? Saying that they don't trust us because they're worried about something we might do that might harm them. So I think it's always these sort of like pieces of that puzzle that, you know, reminds me too of in the Killers of the Flower Moon, right? The Scorsese film, you know, the De Niro character talks about it like, you know, these are people of the past. They're just, their time has passed. And he kind of makes it almost sound like he's doing these people a favor by murdering them and setting up a framework of murder for them, because they're walking on. They're going to be with their ancestors. You know, it's like, it's a perversion of the idea that once you dehumanize someone in a way, make them not of this time, you know, not quite like you, it allows you to do all sorts of these horrible things. And it's like, that part of Killers of the Flower Moon is still haunting me, like just how to, even think about, like, you know, they're just, you know, they're going to join their ancestors, they're moving on, you know, we're murdering them, but that's almost like a favor to them, you know, that kind of thing. And I feel like, you know, there's so many ways that people legitimize war and the killing, the, you know, in war and all of these things, like it's dependent upon all the same things that the settler sort of desires and takings of lands and dehumanizing of people. They're so intertwined. And as we learn more about how capitalism and settler colonialism are so tied together, the continuation. Patrick Wolf talks about, you know, settler states is not like an event in the past, but a structure, an ongoing structure. And I think that idea is sort of resonating with our discussion today.
Harold?
Yeah, I'm glad that Darren just mentioned the word structure, because here we are, is a term that we've used in previous discussions on sovereignty, namely the term structural power as well as structural violence. And I was thinking about Darren's mother, who he referred to in terms of how she came to think about the fact that the people she knew who are basically robbing and a little bit the system, as opposed to the billionaires, as what Darren was trying to point out to her. And I was thinking about capitalism, because capitalism and structural power and structural violence are all intertwined. The capacity to change the name of the game of how legislation is passed, and we see that through lobbying, for example, and the enormous funding that happens behind certain lobbying efforts, so that when new legislation is formulated, who gets to have the last say in what is included and what's excluded in the wording, the commas, the points, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the structural power, which is the capacity to direct the political economy, including in a capitalist society, that's not just the government, but also the economic institutions. And in the case of structural violence, it's easy to see the perpetrator who has, let's say, stabbed you with a knife in your arm, or even worse, has killed your brother or sister, or raped someone, as opposed to in the case of the major polluting industries that have made certain categories of populations very rich. I'm talking here about the oil companies, for example, but not just the oil companies. But there's a massive perpetration of violence whereby people's health is compromised, their lives are being shortened, their lands are being destroyed. As we know, happens in Nigeria, in the Omo Delta, in the Amazon, the massive deforestation, that's all driven by powerful conglomerates often, who have their henchmen on the ground, the people with the machete in the hand or the bulldozer drivers, while they are on the ground confronting indigenous peoples who see their lands being invaded. But the question is, of course, who finances these bulldozers and who finances and profits from? And so back to Darren's mother, these billionaires she doesn't know. And the reason she doesn't know them is because of the nature of capitalism. Capitalism works through many intermediaries. So in other words, the link between the billionaire sitting there in Monaco or at Mar-a-Lago in Florida or somewhere else, the link between that person and what that money does when it makes its money itself, profits, in other words, that can work through 5, 6, 7 times removed. So the removal from the profiteer and his or her victims, that makes it so difficult for a person like Darren's mother to recognize the crimes that are being engaged in terms of crimes against humanity, for example, the financing of who bombs civilian populations at the moment. So here we see President Biden is making, in my view, decisions that are participatory in crimes against humanity. And therefore, we see now a massive assault against the International Court of Justice in The Hague. We see a massive assault on even the United Nations, that the United States itself in 1944 was the major force behind the establishment of the United Nations. But at that time, until the mid-1950s, the United States controlled the United Nations to a large degree, as did the European powers. But ever since independence from the former colonies, it no longer does. And ever since the United Nations and UNESCO as an organization within the United Nations are no longer controlled by the United Nations, by the United States, the United States has taken an increasingly hostile attitude often toward the United Nations if it doesn't do its bidding. And back to the notion of democracy that Darren was referring to, in a democracy, you don't have full control by one person or one nation. It has to be sorted out by a community of nations, which was the notion of the United Nations. So what we see today is a very rapid assault by the United States and its few associates. Increasingly, the United States is becoming isolated in its position, but where it joins forces of the anti-democratic on a global scale, the anti-democratic forces. In other words, the assault under the Biden regime, not under Trump, is a major undermining of the international institutions that have guaranteed to a degree the prevention of World War III.
That's a heavy thought. Darren?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to wrap up, I mean, I think this idea of how, I mean, the Atlantic article talks about it as a propaganda war. I don't think, you know, I hate to think of it that way, that we're in enough communities of care. So it's not merely our propaganda versus theirs, that there is truth and that there is history and there are things we can all stand on and understand collectively. I think it's about a kind of, I mean, with my students and with my family, what I've tried to do is, you know, build up a sense of literacy, you know, a kind of media literacy, a way of thinking critically. At times I feel like that's co-opted as well, right? Which is, you know, when people say things like, do your own research, which I think they mean just like a Google search of a thing that you think you know already. I think that's not research, and getting people to understand what research actually is and how to really challenge assumptions and read through what information you're consuming, I think is really important. So I just want to leave that out there as like a call for all of us to do something better with that.
Harold.
Yeah, I was just reading about a very interesting article about the elite colleges in the United States, and had a specific focus on Harvard University, whereby many students are coming in quite idealistic in terms of what they want to do in terms of making a contribution to the world. But by the time they are halfway through, they switch to majors that allow them to make a lot of money when they graduate. And more than 60% of the Harvard graduates apparently are opting for what is called by them as selling out. In other words, to make as much money as quickly as possible when they graduate. And so I was thinking about my colleagues at Harvard University. What are they failing in? Same thing with democracy and Democrats. Why are they losing the propaganda wars? And that's in this is a serious thought that somehow that the fascists and the right wing and the power mongers are better in terms of mind control, mind influencing than the people who are humanitarians, for example, and who are champions of human rights, champions of indigenous rights. And so that's a real problem. And I think your show, Donna, is an important voice in that regard, to raise issues that aren't apparently raised enough.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to be educated on our own history and our own state. I mean, I think it's easy to go down a rabbit hole and get lost in the huge universe, what else is going on. And I think that it helps to know a little bit about that. But I think for us to be effective, to do something, we need to do it where we can control things, where we have a little bit of our own power and our own focus, and where we can educate ourselves and maybe come up with some kind of strategy that's gonna help us in our positions. So that's why I'm sort of trying to look at the land claims actually from all kinds of different perspectives, and this perspective probably looks like it's way out there and kind of is way out there, but maybe not all that far. And I it's just another way that I'd like to look at this issue. So Harold, you got last word?
Really, I want to thank you, Donna, because you have you're not only hosting this program, but you've also spent your life in terms of service. First time we met, I think you were the president of the Central Maine Indian Association, and that was after you returned from Vietnam when you did your service in Vietnam, and then you worked as head of security, I remember, at Bowdoin College when I was teaching there in the late 1980s, kind of a strange overlap at the time. I remember you ran for office, and so you've kind of really devoted yourself in multiple ways, and now through this Wabanaki Windows show, that you're willing to open up windows, some of which are uncomfortable, some of which are provocative, and the good thing about being provocative is you force people to think, not to tell them what to think, but please do your research, as Darren was just saying, have an open mind, and realize that the answers don't come easy simply because you type in a word on your Google search. For my own journey, I'm 72 years old, and it's taken me to many places in the world, and I've done a lot of thinking and a lot of digging, and I don't have the final answers at all. Because every time I think I have an answer, there's another window, another door that opens, and it puts certain things into question that I thought were true. And that can be very unsettling. And welcome to the club.
And I agree. Thank you, Professors Harold Prince and Dan Ranko, for being on the show today. And thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and John Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.